Hello, everybody. And gotta figure out how to use this watch here. It's not mine. All right, we can. Might as well start right now then. Okay, I just want to thank you all for joining us for the seventh session in our Word Alive Creation series. Thank you all for joining us. And if you haven't seen the previous ones, hopefully you can get the DVDs. I have so much to share today. Today we want to cover some common questions and objections that people have had. Questions and objections that we haven't covered so far. I don't know how we're going to get through all of it. And I'm going to eat up more time by just saying thank you to the Oxford Bible Church for putting on this series, because it's so very important. And I want to thank Jeff for recording this too. Like a real trooper coming out here, even when the weather is like terrible, to record these sessions on audio for the internet. So, all right. So many attacks on the Bible. Is the Bible historically reliable? What about the Big Bang? What about evolution? What about this? What about that? We can't go through all the questions and objections that I've heard and continue to hear. We're going to try to focus on the ones that deal with creation, on what we've been talking about. We can talk about all the historical problems, questions and objections, maybe in another course. But I want to take a look at some popular ones that we haven't gotten to so far. Now remember, we said if we take the Bible, just let the Bible say what it says, and don't read into it man's opinion, then this earth is not that old. It's in the order of about 6,000 years old, somewhere around there. Certainly not billions of years, that's for sure. There's no way to squeeze billions of years into the Genesis record. And it always comes up, people ask, what about carbon-14 dating? What about radiometric dating? Don't those things give the earth an age of millions of years? Now, how many people here right now, if someone came to you and said, what about carbon-14 dating? How many people here are confident they could answer that and defend the Bible? How many are really confident they could do it? Pretty good, pretty good. How many people could use a little help today with that? Oh, good, I'm here for something. All right, good. I have a job after all. Maybe I can shed some light on it. Let's look at carbon-14 dating. Now, without fail, people talk about carbon-14 dating as though it proves the earth millions of years old. Nothing could be further from the truth. As soon as someone says that, you know they don't have a clue what carbon-14 dating is all about. Okay, what is it all about? Radiation from outer space is coming in and penetrating our atmosphere. And it's blasting apart nitrogen. Nitrogen-14 becomes radioactive carbon-14. That's what's going on. And it's converting about 21 pounds of the stuff per year. That's what the scientists tell us. So what happens? This radioactive carbon is up there in the atmosphere. It's radioactive. It just means that it's breaking down. It's not going to stay carbon-14 forever. It's going to revert back to nitrogen after a while. But it's up there along with stable carbon-12 that's not decaying. Both these forms of carbon are combining with oxygen, and you get CO2. And you all know what CO2 is, carbon dioxide. Well, the plants are going to eat the CO2 and make it part of their bodies, and then the animals are going to come along and eat the plants, and then the animals are going to eat each other. And in this way, carbon-14 gets into the food chain. And so this carbon-14 is in you, and it's in me, and it's in everything that we would say is living, and it's breaking down and decaying. Now, the big idea here is when something that was living dies, it stops taking in carbon-14. It's finished. And whatever's in that thing is going to keep on decaying away. The carbon-14 decays until, theoretically, it never goes to zero, but there should be an amount there you can't even detect anymore. Okay, so the big idea here, you dig up something that used to be alive, and you check to see how much carbon-14 is in it. If you find just a little bit, well, this thing died a long, long time ago. And if it has still a lot of carbon-14, well, it's not that old. Okay, that's the idea. So you measure the ratio of carbon-14, radioactive carbon-14, to carbon-12 in the atmosphere. And if your animal that you're dating looks the same, he's only been dead a very short time. Okay. Now, these guys have figured out, they say if you had a pound of carbon-14, we'll say, or any given quantity of carbon-14, in about 5,730 years, half of that quantity is gone. It's decayed away. Okay, so if you dig up an animal and it's only half that ratio is there that you see presently in the atmosphere, you know the animal's been dead for 5,730 years, right? And then in another 5,730 years, which would bring you to 11,460 years or thereabouts, well, you know the animal's been dead that long, right? Because it only has a quarter of the C14 in it. And so it all sounds very good, but there's some assumptions that need to be made. You can use this method if you want to, but there's some assumptions. You have to assume that carbon-14 decays at the same rate always. You just have to believe that it does. No one has ever watched carbon-14 decay, trust me, for 5,000 years. No one's ever watched it. We watched it in a laboratory break down, but we haven't even watched it. It's a very small fraction of a half-life. You have to assume that it always decays at the same rate. You have to assume that your sample's not been contaminated. Nothing's been added to it, and nothing's been taken away. What if carbon-12 has contaminated your sample? Groundwater will do that. It can leach in all kinds of contaminants, and you get a weird age. You get an incorrect age. So nothing's been added. You have to assume nothing's been taken away, and you have to assume to know what was in the atmosphere at the beginning. You got to assume the atmosphere way back then was like today. And these are huge assumptions that you just can't make. Or if you want to make them, just be aware that you're making them. And so you just can't be 100% sure. For example, it's radiation from outer space that's hitting the atmosphere and making carbon-14. Okay? But it's got to pass through the Earth's magnetic field to do it. Well, the Bible says, and I'm pretty sure the Bible's pretty clear on this, there was a canopy above this Earth of water. Now, that's going to affect how much radiation is getting through, and that's going to affect how much C14 is being produced. And so if you don't have that much C14 to begin with, you dig up your animal that died maybe before the flood, it already started off with less C14 than you see today. So you're going to get an artificially old age for this pre-flood animal. That's what we're saying. Plus, the Earth's magnetic field, we just said, that affects how much C14 is getting produced. We know the Earth's magnetic field has not been constant. It is steadily growing weaker and weaker and less intense, which is, by the way, is a great evidence for a young Earth, because the further back you go, the stronger the magnetic field. Until you reach about 20,000 years ago, the Earth's magnetic field would be so strong, nothing could live on planet Earth, just simply because of the heat generated from this field. But the point is, the Earth's magnetic field has not remained constant, so therefore the amount of C14 building up in the atmosphere, you just can't assume to know. You can't assume to know what it was way back then. Plus, a catastrophe like the Genesis flood, we're going to talk about next time, the Genesis flood would have uprooted and destroyed vast amounts of pre-flood forest. So that is going to totally upset and unbalance the carbon inventory in the atmosphere. The whole carbon cycle would have been disrupted. You see, to make carbon-14 dating work, you have to assume uniformity in the natural processes, okay, of planet Earth. And the scientists that use carbon-14 date never consider the Genesis record, and they never consider the flood. But we do, okay? According to the flood model, every flood model that I've ever read about, and if you just read the Bible, the flood was not just a flood, it was a catastrophe. We predict, all sorts of, or I say we retrodict, that there was all sorts of volcanic upheaval as well. All kinds of volcanic eruptions and particulate going into the atmosphere and magma flowing out all over the Earth. Well, did you know that the second most abundant product of volcanic material is carbon dioxide? It's carbon. But this carbon is coming from within the Earth. This is going to be stable carbon-12. Why? Because solar radiation and cosmic radiation has not gotten to it. Okay, this is stable carbon-12. So carbon from within the Earth, you've got stable carbon-12 going up there, it's going to completely unbalance that. That ratio is going to change now. You're going to get artificially old ages for things. You can have a greater gap between how much carbon-14 you have and carbon-12 that you have. And that's the ratio that they're looking for. So I'm saying, if the flood is real, which I believe it is, you dig up something pre-flood, and it's all automatically going to have less C14 in it. And it's going to look old. It's not really all that old. Okay, but never mind all that. The ages that they place on some things when they give a carbon-14 date is sometimes really just unbelievably wild. Okay, I'll just give you some examples here, and we can go on and on for days on this. This is a baby mammoth that was discovered. It says one part of Dima, that's the baby mammoth, was 40,000 years old based on carbon-14. And another part of the same mammoth was 26,000 years old. And the wood immediately around the carcass was 9,000 to 10,000 years old. So this is not an exact science. Okay, guys? This is not an exact science at all. The lower leg of the Fairbanks Creek mammoth had a radiocarbon age of 15,380 radiocarbon years, but its skin and flesh had an age of 21,000. 15 to 21,000 years. Okay. Yeah. You don't want to hang your eternity on this, please, believe me. The two Colorado Creek, Arkansas mammoths had radiocarbon ages of 22,850 and 16,150 years. Look at two mammoths side by side, two crazy dates. One part of the Velosimich mammoth had a radiocarbon age of 29,500 years, another part 44,000. The same mammoth, guys, it's the same creature. You know, and what are the scientists going to say? Well, it must have been contaminated. You know, that's the ace in the hole when they get a date that they don't like. You know, it must have been contaminated. A freshly killed seal was carbon dated as having died 1,300 years ago. We just killed it. We just killed it. Shells from living snails were carbon dated as being 27,000 years old. They're still alive. Guy, this is just, I'm just trying to let you know, this is not an exact science. You know, for anyone who may be watching this, don't let carbon 14 dating fool you into thinking the Bible is wrong. This is a quote, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but this is from the Anthropological Journal of Canada, and this is from the editor of the magazine. He said, the troubles of radiocarbon dating are undeniably deep and serious. This is a scientist talking, you're not a Bible thumper, you know. He says, despite 35 years of technical refinement and better understanding, the underlying assumptions have been strongly challenged, and warnings are out that radiocarbon dating may soon find itself in a crisis situation. Yeah, I could have told you that. He says, it should be no surprise that fully half the dates are rejected. Did you know that? They'll do a radiocarbon test on something, and they'll get a spatter of dates, and they're just going to pick the one that fits evolution. And that's exactly what they do, and I can back that up. Fully half the dates are rejected. It says the radiocarbon method is not capable of yielding accurate and reliable results. I could have told them that too. There are gross discrepancies, the chronology is uneven and relative, and the accepted dates are actually the selected dates. Did you catch that? These guys are picking the dates that they like, that fit the evolution story. And the dates they don't like, they're just going to drop them. This scientist says here, he says, if a C14 date supports our theories, we'll put it in the main text of our paper. If it does not entirely contradict them, we'll put it in a footnote. And if it's completely out of date, we'll just drop it. You see that? And remember, they're doing that with about half the dates. No less than half the dates. How about that? The scientist says here, it may come as a shock to some, but fewer than 50% of the radiocarbon dates from geological and archaeological samples in northeastern North America have been adopted as acceptable by investigators. You see that? What? This is just not the gospel, you know, written in stone, guys. Don't let anyone fool you. So if someone comes to you with the argument about carbon 14, just tell them, look, there's so many assumptions you have to make that you can't prove, and the dates that you get are totally wild. They've always been wild dates, and you're just picking the dates you like. So, I mean, if it doesn't work on things you know the age of, what makes you think that it's going to be reliable on when you date something you know that you don't know the age of? It make any sense at all? So carbon 14 dating is only good for maybe 50,000 years. By then, all the carbon-14 that should have been in that thing is gone, or should be gone. But they're finding today that they're finding carbon-14 even in the oldest fossils, which is very interesting because it all should be gone after 50,000 years. How are they finding them in fossils 5 million years old? But they're finding it in diamonds. That's right, they're finding them in diamonds. Anyway, we can get into that another time. I want to talk about other forms of radiometric dating. When they get these ages of millions of years and billions of years, how are they getting these kind of dates? Well, it's really the same concept, but now they're going to date rocks. Instead of something that was once alive, they date rocks now. Volcanic material. So on the top left, you see uranium-238, and uranium will decay, and it goes through all these different stages, and it finally becomes lead. See lead at the bottom, 206? And so they say they know how long this takes. And they say after a volcano erupts, all the lead is gone, and all you got is the uranium. And so the idea is you pick up your rock sample, and you see how much uranium is left in this thing, how much lead has accumulated. And they'll do the same thing with rubidium. Rubidium will become strontium, or potassium will become argon. There's a whole pile of these things, but the concept's the same. You think you know how fast it takes, and then you just measure how much is left and how much daughter product has accumulated, and you think you got it, the age of the rock. But you're going to have to make some assumptions again. Okay? So here's just the chart showing, you know, 100% uranium, and it decays away, and as the uranium decays, you get lead accumulating, and so you pick up your rock, and, oh, whoa, wow, look at this, there's only a little bit of uranium left. Goodness, must be very, very old. Okay. You got to assume once again that you know how fast this process happens. They say that the half-life of uranium is 4.5 billion years. I don't know of anyone who's watched it decay for 4.5 billion years. Nobody has. So you have to assume to know that. You have to assume to know that the rock has not been contaminated. Uranium has not been washed out of your rock. Nothing's been added to the rock. No lead has been washed in. You know, given the Earth's cataclysmic history, I don't think that's a very reasonable thing to say. Okay? Or to assume, by the way. And you have to assume to know what was there in that rock at the beginning. How can you assume to know any of that? You just can't. Okay? So, anyone comes to you with radiocarbon 14 dating, this proves the Earth is old, or radiometric dating, this proves... No. You got to make all kinds of assumptions. Okay? And you get wild dates on top of it. You don't know any of these things. Okay? We don't even know why these things decay. No one knows why atoms decay. Why does uranium become lead? Who knows? This evolutionist says, for some inexplicable reason, the nuclei of certain elements becomes unstable and spontaneously release energy and or particles. They don't even know why it happens. If you can't explain why, do you really want to hang your eternity on this process? I don't think you want to. But just to show you that when the evolutionist comes to you with these kind of arguments, he doesn't even believe these things. He really doesn't. When they conflict with evolution, he doesn't. Remember the little tong fossil I had in here a couple sessions ago? And this man picked it up and he thought he had a hominid there. He thought he had a missing link. Well, they did two different kinds of radiometric dating techniques on this fossil, on the area it was taken from. And both of them came back way too young for evolution. Both, two different independent radiometric dates said less than 1 million years. Okay. So the scientist said, well, for tong, an age of 2 million years is more reasonable. But the argument is obviously circular, and the true age remains uncertain. What, you just did two different radiometric dates, but it gave you an age you don't like. So they'll drop. They don't care about radiometric dating if it conflicts with evolution. They don't care about it. So they shouldn't be down on you when you don't care about it because it conflicts with creation. You see what I'm saying? We both have our religions, right? Don't we? This skull, KNMAR 1470, it was discovered under volcanic material that was radiometrically dated at 220 million years old. That's dinosaur age rock. Not supposed to find a primate underneath that rock, but they did. And what did they do? Well, they just tossed the date. And they gave it an age they wanted. And I think today it sits at about 1.9 million years old. See, radiometric dating is not in stone, not even for the evolutionist. If it conflicts with evolution, they'll toss it out. It's just a quote here saying how they had gotten firm dates of 212 to 220 million years for that volcanic material. But they didn't care because it conflicted with evolution. This is a volcano that exploded in New Zealand. Here's the 5 most recent eruptions. People were there to see it happen. They took 13 samples from the flows from these eruptions, and they had them radiometrically dated. Look at the dates they got. We watched it happen. We watched this thing, explode. They got 4 of the dates came back at less than 270,000 years. One of them at less than 290,000. One at 800,000. One at 1 million. One at 1.2 million. One at 1.3. One at 1.5. And they got one at 3.5 million years. And all the dates were supposed to be within a margin of 20% error. Now, which of these is correct? None of them. None of them are correct. What is the deal here? You generally this is not reliable. You try it on something you know the age of, and it comes back with a date that's not reliable. What makes you think you can take radiometric dating and apply it to something you don't know the age of, and voila, you're going to get a date that's correct? Why would you think that when it doesn't work on things you know the age of? It doesn't make any sense to me at all. So there's just so many unknowns here. The scientist here, he says, radiometric dating would not have been feasible if the geologic column had not been erected first. Okay, what's the geologic column that's so very important? Well, remember the Earth has layers in it? Well, this guy his name is Charles Lyell, back in about 1831, he drew up this chart called the geologic column. He gave names and ages to the layers, and the evolutionists still use the chart, and they say that we can trace the evolution of animals' life and plant life upward through the rock layers. But the column doesn't exist. That's the problem. It doesn't exist on planet Earth. It's a figment of somebody's imagination. Okay? This geology textbook here, it said, because we cannot find sedimentary rock should be rock layers representing all of Earth time neatly in one convenient area, we must piece together the rock sequence from locality to locality. They're just putting it together the way they want it to be, okay? And the Encyclopedia Britannica calls it a mental abstraction. The geologic column is a mental abstraction. It's an idea that somebody has about Earth history, okay? That's all it is. And this thing is being used to measure how accurate radiocarbon dating is, or radiometric dating. You see that? If radiometric dating conflicts with the geologic column, which is a mental abstraction, we'll toss the radiocarbon dates out. So, I mean, how circular is this guy? I mean, it's completely circular, okay? So, I'm going to leave it there on radiocarbon dating. Is everyone a little more clearer now that some really weird assumptions need to be made, assumptions you can't prove, and they get all kinds of wild dates, and they reject about half of them. So you can share that with your friends. And if you need more on this topic, I have tons more on our website, okay, about radiometric dating. But I want to move ahead to microevolution and macroevolution. I want to look at biology now, just a little bit. We touched on this, but I really want to get into it a little bit more with you, okay? People say animals produce a variety of animals. Cats and dogs produce a variety. And the argument is if they can produce this kind of variety in a short period of time, what if the Earth was really that old? If the Earth was millions of years old, perhaps one kind of animal could really diversify enough to be called a different kind of animal. And that's the argument that you hear, okay? Look at all the varieties of dogs that we created in just 100 years or 200 years. What if we had millions of years? Well, I want to talk about that because it's never going to happen. I want to take that argument away from the evolutionist because it's not right. It's not accurate at all. Remember Charles Darwin, he read Charles Lyell's book, which said the Earth was so old, and he took that book with him on his journey to the Galapagos Islands, and by the time he got there, he was convinced the Earth was old, much older than the Bible said, and he looked at the life that was on those islands, and he said, look at all the varieties among those finches. Look at all the different kinds of beaks they got. Oh, wow. And he said, you know what? I bet you all those birds had a common ancestor. And I say, yeah, he's absolutely right. The ancestor was a bird. But he said, no. Because we have millions of years to play with, that ancestor of the birds could have been our ancestor, too. Everything could be related together. And that's what he said. That's what he thought. Could this happen? Is this possible? No, it's not possible, no matter how much time you allot. That's the point. It doesn't matter how much time you're going to allot to this problem. Never going to happen. What is scientific here? Dogs producing varieties of dogs, cats producing varieties of cats. That's scientific. That's observable. We can see that happening right now in real time. But to suppose that dogs and cats shared a common ancestor, we've just crossed the boundary from science to religion, because no one's ever seen anything like it. And no one's ever watched a dog become anything other than a dog. And that goes for every other kind of animal that's out there. It's just, animals are doing just what Genesis said they're going to do. They're going to reproduce according to their kinds. This idea that reptiles evolved into birds is ridiculous. reptiles do produce a variety of their kind, sure. I would say God programmed them to do that so they can live in a number of different environments. Dogs produce a variety of dogs, so they can live in a number of environments. But to go from a reptile to a bird, wow, you got to make some... I mean, how many people have figured out you got to make some major changes to your body plan to become a bird, right? Here we have some birds in the Fort Worth Zoo. They're talking about how they got all kinds of neat new colors. And how did it happen? How did they get these neat new colors of parakeets that no one ever saw before? Well, they just bred the birds, recombined genetic material that was already there in the population. They just breeding experiments, that's all. And they got neat colors that no one ever saw before. But nothing new. They just recombined the same genetic information that was always there. And the same thing with dogs. This biologist says a rule of all breeders recognize is that there are fixed limits to the amount of change that can be produced. I agree. My brother-in-law breeds cattle. I asked him, hey, in all your years of breeding cattle, have you ever heard of a cow giving birth to something that wasn't a cow? He just looked at me like I was stupid. I said, are you kidding? Never. Never going to happen. There are limits to this, right? Here we have the dogs on top. They have medium-length fur. They have puppies. Some puppies have medium-length fur. Some have long, and some have short fur. All of a sudden, the environment gets really, really cold. Now, in that litter, which dogs are going to survive? long fur dogs. The rest are dead. They can't pass on their genetic traits. So in future generations, what do you got left with? Long fur dogs. Now what if the environment gets super scalding hot? Were they going to start producing short fur dogs again? Nope. We've lost something. The animal has adapted, the population has adapted, but that's evolution in reverse because we've lost information. And evolution requires an increase in genetic information. To go from an amoeba to a man, you better believe there's got to be an increase in genetic information. The amoeba doesn't have the information for hair color or eye color because it doesn't have hair or eyes. It doesn't have information for that, okay? So, we can purebreed dogs, but guess what you're doing? You are weeding out information. The poodle, you can breed as many poodles together as you want. You're never going to get a Great Dane out of them. Because that information is gone. It's lost. Okay? And so you actually have you have less information for further change. This is a quote from 1979. Stephen Stanley wrote a book on macroevolution. He said, macroevolution is decoupled from microevolution. He's saying the little changes you see in animal kinds, you cannot extrapolate that to make huge changes, huge evolutionary changes. He says that's an entirely different thing going on there. And I agree. I totally agree, 100%. The macroevolution conference was held in Chicago in 1980, and according to this scientist, Roger Lewin, writing for Science Magazine, it was a turning point in the history of evolutionary history. Okay? He said the central question of the Chicago conference was whether the mechanisms underlying microevolution can be extrapolated to explain the phenomena of macroevolution. At the risk of doing violence to the positions of some of the people at the meeting, the answer can be given as a clear no. And that was in 1980. Okay, you see that? So just because dogs and cats produce a variety, even the scientists will tell you, that doesn't mean that that sort of change that you see there can be extrapolated and over millions of years make the animal become something different. And then what is making animals evolve? They don't have a clue. They really don't have a clue. This is from 1991. Lynn Margulies, very famous biologist, she says, I've seen no evidence whatsoever that these changes can occur through gradual accumulation of gradual mutations. See, even she's not convinced. What is the mechanism for evolution? There is none. That's the problem. that's one of the problems. The biggest problem is it conflicts with God's word, but this is from the year 2000. It just says, outsiders to this rich literature may find it a surprise, may be surprised that there is no consensus on this issue, and that strong viewpoints are held at both ends of the spectrum with many undecided. The scientists do not know what causes an animal to become a different kind of animal. That's their religion. That's the religion that they've chosen. And we've chosen our religion. And I think ours makes infinitely more sense. Because we have a mechanism for the things that we're proposing here. They have nothing. Okay? So, about microevolution, the changes that you see are caused by genetic material already there. That's the variations that you see. The genetic information is already there in the population. We're just doing breeding experiments and recombining the material and getting neat traits. Okay? So the traits that you haven't seen before isn't because new things are being created. It's just that new combinations are being created. We're jumbling up the DNA in different ways now as we breed these animals together. It's not evolution. And all animal breeders will tell you that there are fixed limits. There is a limit, you know. You can breed cows. You can just keep breeding the biggest cows. Just keep breeding the biggest cows. You're going to end up with what? A really big cow, but you will never get a cow as big as a house, you know. And I talked to my brother-in-law, and he said, yeah, you know, the problem is you can keep breeding for size, but then all of a sudden the animal will be deficient in something else. It may become disease-prone. Or if you might breed it for milk production, you just keep breeding the cows that produce a lot of milk, and you end up with a cow that breeds that can produce a lot of milk, but there might be something else wrong with it. So God has imposed these limits here. And the animal breeders know it, okay? Mutations that are supposed to be the driving force of evolution are harmful, and they delete information. They don't never add information. They're almost always harmful, okay? And on rare occasions, something may happen, a freaky thing may happen, and it may help the animal survive in a particular environment, but never do they give additional information, add information to the DNA. And that's what evolution requires. Mutations can't do it, and they've never done it, ever. So mutations cannot possibly be the driving force of evolution. What about this idea that animals can go from, say, a reptile to a bird? Well, somewhere along the way, you're going to wind up with an animal with useless legs. and useless wings. Because this is happening slowly, remember, over millions of years? So what selective advantage does that animal have? Nothing. He's the first one to get eaten. But evolution says, with each slight change, the animal is better suited and better equipped, and he will be selected. Well, you can't imagine how an animal with useless wings and useless legs could be better fit for his environment. I mean, where was he living anyway? But that could be, you know, ridiculous. And last of all, not all scientists agree anyways. Just because you see variety means nothing. Many scientists, they believe that something else is going on that causes one kind of animal to change into a different kind of animal. So, just because you see variety within living things, that's no evidence for evolution, okay? And the last point I want to make here is that the Bible told us 10 times, no less than 10 times in Genesis chapter 1, things are going to reproduce according to their kinds. And evolution requires that things don't reproduce according to their kinds. And God only has to tell us something once for it to be true. And I think he told us 10 times because God anticipated this resistance to his word. You know, that we're getting pounded with evolution all the time. So God said, as a matter of fact, I'm going to tell you 10 times because you people in the 21st century are just ever so dull that you can actually believe this ridiculous evolution story. So I'm going to leave it there on microevolution, if that helps you at all. I hope it does. Let's talk about bacteria. Doesn't bacteria become resistant to penicillin? How does it become resistant to certain drugs? Isn't that evolution? How many people have heard that? Bacteria becomes resistant. Oh man, it's evolving right in front of our eyes. We're all doomed. You know, superbugs. Well, this is not proof for evolution. Not at all. Okay? Most of these bacteria were already resistant to the antibiotics. Antibiotic resistance was already there in the population, in the bacteria. Okay, but if you introduce an antibiotic to that population, guess which bacteria survive? The ones that are resistant. But they were already there. It's not evolution. You know, nothing new is happening. This encyclopedia says some members of the bacterial strain are resistant to certain drugs naturally. It says in the course of time, they can eventually become selected through evolutionary forces to become the dominant drug-resistant forms of a pathogenic strain. That's not evolutionary forces. Are you kidding? Members of the Franklin expedition were frozen in 1845. In their bodies were found to contain drug-resistant bacteria. But the antibiotics were only created in the 1940s. See, people say, oh, we're introducing so many antibiotics. We're causing a bacteria to evolve. No, you're not. It was always there. Antibiotic resistance was always there in the population. Nothing's evolving in front of our eyes. This textbook says, many studies have shown that the drug penicillin does not induce mutations for resistance. Taking antibiotics is not causing these things to evolve. How many people have heard that? These things are evolving. Oh, no. Well, they're not. The ones that are naturally resistant are reproducing. That's all. We're getting more of those guys now. But there's no Darwinian evolution going on here. The scientist says the genetic variants required for resistance to the most diverse kinds of pesticides were apparently present in every one of the populations exposed to these man-made compounds. Pesticide-resistant bugs, they're already there. We didn't make them. We didn't see them evolve. We're just seeing more of them now because they're surviving. Okay? Now, sometimes a bacteria that was not resistant can become resistant. But it's not because he's evolving. Other bacteria will inject him with genetic material and enable him to become resistant. It's called conjugation. A small amount of genetic information may be present in smaller DNA molecules called plasmids. Bacterial plasmids often bear genes evolved and resistant to antibiotics. And it's through this process called conjugation or infection, you know, one kind of bacteria will endow another kind of bacteria with resistance to antibiotics. But this encyclopedia says it does not depend on the lengthy process of mutation. So it's not evolution going on here, guys. You see that? So here we have an E. coli. It's about to become resistant. See, there's a bacteria, there's a plasmid there about to enter the cell. It's not evolution. Okay? Now, do mutations happen to bacteria? Well, sometimes. The encyclopedia says once in several hundred million cell divisions, you may get a mutation. And the mutation alters the bacterium's genetic code and thus its ability to use certain chemicals for its life activities. So a mutation may creep in, but it's going to make the bacteria less healthy. It's not going to use its chemicals properly. Not going to use it most efficiently, okay? That's all we're saying. Here we have this is a gastric pathogen, the Helicobacter pylori. And this is in many people have this in their guts, and it causes, you know, all kinds of problems. But this little critter here, some of them have undergone a mutation. They have mutated. They normally produce an enzyme, which turns, normally they do this. This enzyme that they produce causes antibiotics to become a poison and will destroy their own DNA. But a mutation has crept in and has stopped producing that enzyme. So this little critter becomes resistant. Has evolution happened here? No. This thing has lost the ability to do something it should have been doing. It just so happens it allows it to be resistant to the antibiotic, but it's not evolved. It's lost something. This is the opposite of evolution. It's not evolution, okay? So that's all I'm saying. Drug resistance, antibiotic resistance, mostly they're already there in the population. And when the odd time when mutations are responsible, it's because something has altered the way that bacteria produces or handles its chemicals. That's it. Okay? So it's not evolution, though. We've never seen anything evolve. Which brings me to my next point here. The propaganda machine is running full force, folks. This Discover magazine came out not too long ago. It says, we've proven evolution at long last. Scientists at Michigan State prove evolution works. And this is a very recent magazine. Wow, you know, for the last 150 years, they've been jamming it down our throats, and now, just now, they've proven it. Wow, was it just faith before, or what? They say that computers have proven it now. Oh, thank goodness now. It's no longer a religion. Have computers proven evolution? I don't think they have. I won't read the whole thing, but the article, basically what they've done, they've created digital organisms on a computer. And then the organisms can't do any mathematics. But as these organisms divide and replicate, mutations are apparently introduced, allowing them to recognize numbers. And as these digital organisms can recognize more and more numbers, they have the ability to do mathematics. And they reward, every time something goes right, the computer programmer rewards the organism by allowing it to reproduce more of its kind. And he said, you know what? In just a few generations, wow, these organisms were math whizzes. Within 6 months, Adami's organisms were addition whizzes. Wow. We've proved it. We've just proved evolution. What, because your digital organisms can evolve, you've proved evolution? Are you kidding me? And this is their star witness right now. I think it's one of their star witnesses. Yeah. Wow. Okay. I realize I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. Okay, I admit it. But I can figure out that computers do what the programmer tells them to do. You know that? You tell a computer to do something, and hopefully mine doesn't always do what I tell it to do, but... You know, there are video games out there. You can program a computer to make your motocross jump 600 feet. You can do that. You can tell the computer to do that. Does that mean that in real life, oh, just because the computer can do it, now real motocross riders can make their bikes go 600 feet? Does that make any sense to anybody here? Ridiculous. That is the most ridiculous. And they cut down a tree to print that article. Can you believe that? We've proven it now. Absolutely ridiculous. He says, the beauty of digital life is that you can watch it happen step by step. In every step, you would not ordinarily see that there's a goal you're going toward. Yeah, he's making this happen. He's making evolution happen. He's coaxing along the reactions, you know. In real life, this is supposed to be random. This is supposed to be survival of the fittest, you know. This is supposed to be, you know, nature, red and tooth and claw. These things are not similar in any way, shape, or form. These organisms on his computer screen, he starts with things that are living, you know, apparently living, which doesn't explain where life came from. We don't even know where all the chemicals for life came from. We don't know how to make DNA. The rewards that he treats his digital organisms to are nothing like real life. Okay? His organisms have selective advantage. We still can't imagine how an animal with a half-formed wing could have selective advantage. His experiments cannot explain symbiotic relationships. That's relationships between animals that absolutely need each other, like the termite and the little critter that lives in the termite's intestine. He needs that guy to break down the food, and the little critter in the intestine needs the termite to eat the food. How do you explain those kinds of things? You know, the yucca moth and the yucca plant. How do you explain those kinds of things? Or the cleaner fish goes inside the big fish's mouth and keeps it clean and feeds off, you know. How do you explain these kinds of things? His little computer story will not explain those things either. It cannot explain sexual reproduction either. Not at all. As a matter of fact, his computers would select against that. So, if anyone tells you that computers have proven it, you can just share some of this with them. They have not. Most certainly they have not. Now, I was down in Florida a couple of years back. We were on a radio program down there, and a guy had called in, and he says, I have proof for evolution. He said, we have junk DNA. The human beings have junk DNA, and the junk DNA falls in the same places as the junk DNA on the chimpanzee's DNA, and we know that the junk DNA accumulates randomly, so therefore, we have a common ancestry, okay? Well, first of all, you don't know that these things accumulate randomly, and second of all, you certainly don't know that this is truly junk DNA. Just because you don't know what it does doesn't mean it has no function, you know? I look under the hood of my car, I haven't got a clue what anything does, okay? But I believe that there's functions for everything in there. Hopefully, I mean, same thing with my computer. But this is an article from Discover Magazine 2003, talking about junk DNA. They removed some of that junk DNA from some mice and found out that the mice didn't do very well. Can you see that? Not doing so good there. Jeannie Lee, a geneticist at Howard Hughes Medical Institute in Boston, suspects that the pseudogene may function as a decoy to lure away destructive enzymes. That may be one of the functions of this so-called junk DNA, you know. And if so, then that is evidence for design. Absolutely. That's forethought of a intelligent designer, creator, right? The scientist says the term junk DNA is a reflection of our ignorance. I agree. That caller was ignorant. He was. I heard him. Believe me, he was ignorant. Science Magazine says recent studies indicate that ncRNAs are far more abundant and important than initially imagined. Well, I could have said that. I could have told you that. And I don't know anything. The source says the failure to recognize the importance of introns, the so-called junk DNA, may well go down as one of the biggest mistakes in the history of molecular biology. See, I didn't have an answer for that guy. Thankfully, I was with someone who did have an answer for that caller. You know, and he knew some of this stuff. But you see, just don't give up your Bible just because you don't have an answer. Go have a look. I bet you find it. It won't be very hard to find either. I guarantee it. What was damned as junk because it was not understood may, in fact, turn out to be the very basis of human complexity. There is no junk DNA, folks. Now, some people say, well, look at the similar anatomical structures. Boy, we have two bones in our wrist, and so does the dog and the whale and the bat, you know. That must mean we have a common, what, ancestor or a common designer. It may very well be that the same designer creator is responsible for all of us. You know, and he put his, you know, if everything was completely, totally different and with no similarity at all, you might get the impression that there was more than one creator. But God has put his fingerprint on things, I feel, and a good design is something that he's repeated a few times over with slight modification. But to show you that just because things are similar doesn't mean they revolve one from another, just take a look at our skeleton here, okay? If you take a look at the arm on the left and the leg on the right, boy, there's some similarities, aren't there? The upper bone is one solid piece. The lower bone has two bones, actually. And there's five digits at the bottom. Oh, I guess that means my arm evolved from my leg. No one believes that. Right? They say we evolved from the fish's fin. That's what they say. That's what the scientists say. So therefore, similar anatomy does not mean evolutionary relationship. Right? Pretty simple argument, I think. I think it works. Well, just to show you, we have five digits on our fingers, or on our hand, right? You got five fingers. Hey, the frog's got five too. But did you know these things develop in totally different ways? The human loses cells in between each digit, and so you end up with these five appendages, right? But the frogs just grow right out of the stump. They actually grow outward. So you have a similar structure that develops in totally different ways. To me, that makes sense. It makes sense that there's a common designer here. Because if these things were related, I would expect that they would develop the same way. Okay? Jonathan Wells says, homologous structures are often not produced by similar developmental pathways. That's just what we saw. And they're often not produced by similar genes even, which is important. There's no empirically demonstrated mechanism to establish that homologies are due to common ancestry rather than common design. In other words, they don't have any good argument to show that just because things are similar, they evolve from one from another. They got no argument for that. Okay? Look at the eye. Darwin said the eye made him shudder because it was so complex. How could this thing evolve? He said, it's absurd in the highest degree to think that natural selection could do it. But he believed it anyways. But that's just one kind of eye. There are zillions of different kinds of eyes out there. The insect eye is way different than a human eye. Way different. How did that evolve? Did the miracle happen more than once? Remember what I said? In a universe where nothing saw anything, if evolution is true, then who decided it was time to start seeing? I'd like to know. How did the insect eye just evolve? How did the human eye just evolve? And you know what? They're so totally different, but yet they share the same gene. The PAX6 gene appears in the very different insect eye and in the human eye. Now, how do you figure that? We're supposed to have totally different ancestries. Completely different. Look at the branches. We split off right off. After we were the blob, we just split off. You see that? Way back then when we were just a blob. Science Magazine says, because PAX6 has evolved in the genetic control of eye morphogenesis in both mammals and insects, the traditional view that the vertebrate eye and the compound eye of insects evolved independently has to be reconsidered. Yeah, I would say. Common design. Okay? Common design. Makes a whole lot more sense. Look at the owl's eye. The owl doesn't even have a round eye like a ball. He's got something like a tin can. He can't roll his eye around like you can. They're just like, you know, when he's looking at you, he's just looking at you. He's really looking at you. How did that evolve? How could that evolve? I like to see the steps in between. How could that have happened? And the evolutionist says this must have happened like 40 times, eyes evolving. Really, really hard to imagine. You take a look at an octopus. And the octopus has an eye that's kind of like a human's eye. In many ways, it's very similar to the human eye. The camera eye of the octopus is very similar to that of humans. Okay, what's the big deal? Well, the evolutionist says we have a case of convergent evolution here, folks. Why does he say that? Well, they say you and I evolved from a fish, right? In the beginning, there was a common ancestor that had no backbone. Then this thing became something with a backbone, and it became a fish, and then it became you. Isn't that nice to know? But you don't share an eyeball that looks anything like a fish's eye. But you share an eyeball that looks like the octopus's eye. Octopi eye, I guess. But the octopus doesn't have a skeleton. He doesn't got a bone in his body. Now, how do you figure that we got eyes from him? Or did he get eyes from you? Or did the same creator just endow us with eyes? Makes a whole lot more sense. Because this is a great evolutionary mystery. Okay? Richard Leakey said, there's always a possibility of making mistakes and inferring close evolutionary relations between species to share an anatomical structure. I agree, Richard. I agree. Similar anatomy does not always imply close evolutionary relationship. Sure. It implies common design. That's all. You take a look at some of the weird animals in the world. I think God put the platypus on Earth just to drive the evolutionists crazy. It has fur and it suckles its young like a mammal, but it's got a shoulder girdle and lays leathery eggs like a reptile. A bill like a duck, feet like an otter, tail like a beaver, and venom like a snake. What did he evolve from? What's he becoming? Anyone want to guess? Hey, I think it's God's gift to the evolutionist. You just can't imagine. How many people have seen the bombardier beetle before? The bombardier beetle. This guy, when a predator wants to come and eat the beetle, this guy is going to shoot a hot liquid out of his rear end, 212 degrees Fahrenheit. I know people that do that. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Just kidding. Anyways, here's a nice picture. Here's the frog. He's going to take the beetle out for lunch. See the beetle outside the frog's mouth? Oh, beetle in the frog's mouth. Beetle outside the frog's mouth again. And I love that frog's face. Oh, my goodness. Okay. 500 pulses a second out that beetle's rear end. Very complex chemical cascade. Chemical reactions have to happen. And he's got to have a trigger and a gun mechanism out his rear end to make this happen. Lots of things better be happening just right. And he better keep those chemicals on a short leash and keep them separate, or the beetle's going to blow himself up. Can you just imagine? Now, how did this evolve? How did it evolve in steps? The biology textbook says neither the peroxide or the catalyst is useful by itself. We might well ask from the beginnings of the Beatles, present mechanism could have evolved. How could it have evolved? Anyways, nobody has a clue. The textbook doesn't have a clue. What about metamorphosis? You know, the caterpillar becomes a butterfly. He goes into a cocoon and becomes a pulp-like liquid. He reassembles himself as a capable flyer. How did that evolve? Every step in the animal's evolution is supposed to give it selective advantage. What is the advantage in learning how to dissolve your body into a liquid? Anyone want to guess? That's like, you know, driving your truck into the garage, covering it over, and voila, it just assembles itself into an airplane. It's just as ridiculous. Can you imagine such a thing? There's no evidence of how such a remarkable plan ever came about. They don't know how metamorphosis happens. They just don't know. I've only got a couple minutes. I only got 10 minutes left, but I want to address some issues that are not, maybe not specific to creation, but that might help us out. These are issues that you normally hear, and we can touch on them. What about evil and suffering in the world? You often hear this. What about evil and suffering? Well, how can there be a good God? Look at Adolf Hitler, and he killed all those people, you know, mass graves, and the Twin Towers went down, and there's so much evil in the world. How can God allow this kind of thing to happen? Why is there evil? Well, this is what you can share with people. You can ask people, you say, dear friend, what is the greatest good? Can you think of the greatest good? And let them think about it, but bring them to this. What about love? I don't think he'll come up with a greater good than love. He won't be able to. Love is the greatest good. I mean, help me if I'm wrong, but I can't think of a greater good. And the Bible tells you all about love. Real love, real self-sacrificing, unselfish, giving, caring, committed love. That's the greatest good in the world. And God's love to mankind is the greatest good for us, for sure. Okay? What about love, anyways? Can you force someone to love? Oh, you can't. You know, like, when a parent loves their child, the child has done nothing to earn that love, I can tell you. They cry all night, and they poopy diapers and all of it. But you just love them to death, you know, you just love them. And the Bible says God is love, right? The greatest good is love, and God is the greatest good. Let me ask you a question. How many flowers live in the Antarctic? How many flowers have you seen there? I've seen zero. Every show I ever saw said, flowers can't live in the Antarctic. Okay, plants need an environment that they can live in. I think that love needs an environment that it can live into. Okay, this is my family, and we love each other, even the dog. You know that environment that is that love survives? Love survives in an environment of choice. You gotta be able to choose to love or not to love. You need the choice. And God gave Adam and Eve choice. And he gave human beings choice to love or not to love. Okay? And our first human parents decided to rebel against God. And now the earth is suffering for that. Whole creation groans and travails. They chose to disobey. Well, God chose to save his fallen creation too. Because God loves. God chose to do that. Now listen. This is what I'm getting at. If you want to stop evil, God can stop all the evil. He can do it right now, immediately. But it's going to require some things happen. Okay? To stop evil, right away, God's got to stop choice. You know, the guy wants to choose to do something evil, God steps on him. No, you don't. You don't. You're not doing anything. And no more evil. That's it. So God stops choice. Right? But now you stop choice, you stop love, remember? Because love requires choice. To choose to love or not to love. That means you stop the greatest good. Love is the greatest good, remember? And if you stop the greatest good, you've just committed the greatest evil. That's the way I look at it. You can stop evil, but you gotta become a dictator and stop choice. Stop choice, you stop the possibility for love. You stop the possibility of love, you've just stopped the possibility of the greatest good happening. You stop the greatest good from happening, my friend, you've just committed the greatest evil. That's why there's evil in the world, because God wants there to be love here too. And there is love here. How else can we explain a world such as we live in? I can't explain it any other way. But I think that helps you. I think there's wickedness in the world because people are choosing to be wicked. Okay? But some people choose to love. God chose to love us. I hope that we will all choose to love him too. How can loving God send people to hell? That's a question you normally get. The Bible talks about the lake of fire. The devil and the false prophet are going to be tossed into the lake of fire. I want to say that hell was not designed for people anyways. The devil who deceived them was cast in the lake of fire where the beast and the false prophet are. Jesus said in Matthew 25, he's going to send people into everlasting fire that was prepared for the devil and his angels. Hell is not for people. People are choosing to go there when they reject God. That place is not for people. God wants people to be saved. God wills that all men be saved. It's not fair to lay this on God and say, how can a loving God send people to hell? People are choosing one way or another. God says in Ezekiel 18, I take pleasure in the death of no one. Turn yourselves and live. God wants all people to be saved. Right? Who will all have all men to be saved. I think there's gradation. I don't think all the torment in hell is going to be the same for everybody. Jesus said that this religious hypocrisy says these people will receive the greater damnation, which is a sobering thought. Wow. Jesus told a parable in Luke 12. He said, that servant which knew not his Lord's will and prepared not himself, neither did according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes. But he that knew not, he'll get few stripes for not obeying. So I see a gradation there. Not everyone's going to suffer the same. I don't believe. If that helps. So hell's not for everybody, and not all torment will be the same. But let me put it this way. Charles Darwin and his bulldog, Henry Huxley, hated God, and they fought against Christianity, and they did everything they could to get people not to believe. Adolf Hitler said Christianity was the most fatal and seductive lie ever. He wanted nothing to do with Jesus. Charles Templeton wanted nothing to do with Jesus. He wrote books to try to convince you to have nothing to do with Jesus. Richard Dawkins says you're stupid and evil if you believe in God. They want nothing to do with God. In this life, they want nothing to do with God. How fair would it be for God to force them into his heaven when they die? It wouldn't be fair at all. God's going to give people what they're asking for. You know? So ask for salvation and he'll give it to you. Wouldn't be fair. If that helps you, I hope that helps. Last thing I want to mention here in our last couple minutes. What about religion causing all kinds of wars? Well, for sure, people have died because of religious wars. Sure they have. People calling themselves Christians have gone and killed people, tortured people. For sure they have. I'm not going to deny that. But what about the witch hunts and the Inquisition and all the rest of it? Yeah. Religion has caused lots of war. I personally think that that's never been proven. I think class struggles have been the cause of more wars, but even if religion is the major cause, big deal. I know Islam takes it serious. There's lots of Islamics that take the Quran seriously. It says, kill the adulterers wherever you find them. Lie in wait for them at every place of ambush. But if they repent and observe prayer and pay the zakat, leave their way free. So it's almost like a stick-up, eh? But that's Islam. And these lots of Islamics are doing terrible things for their religion. No question about it. But Jesus said, my kingdom's not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight. You cannot look at the atrocities committed by everyone who claimed to be a Christian and say that those things were sanctioned by Jesus Christ, because they were not. Completely inconsistent. Jesus said you're to love your enemies and bless those that persecute you and curse you. You're supposed to do good to those people. How about turning the other cheek? Remember that? Jesus never sanctioned the Crusades. I will repay, says the Lord. Romans 12. Jesus said, feed your enemy. Feed him, and if he's thirsty, give him to drink. Wow, that's most unlike the Quran. So what I'm saying is, the Crusades, the Inquisition, and all those horrible things, inconsistent with the Bible. Consistent with the Quran, though. And maybe other religions. But you can't lay this at God's doorstep. Okay? But what about evolution? What does that teach? What does secular humanism teach? Racism? Charles Darwin's book had to do with this preservation of favored races. He says the civilized races will exterminate the savage races. He says from the war of nature and famine and death, the production of higher animals follows. I mean, he was writing at a time when you could buy black people, for crying out loud. They were considered less evolved than white people. I can't read all these quotes here, but here's a man here who's taken from his tribe and thrown in a zoo as an evolution display. He finally went crazy and killed himself. He's put in a cage with chimpanzees. Unbelievable. Australian Aborigines were killed, their skulls put in museums and shipped off to be evolution displays. Have we all not one father? Hath not one God created us? You know, God says we are made from all from one blood. We're all brothers. in that sense. Same creator. Arthur Keith said, Hitler wanted the world to conform to the theory of evolution, survival of the fittest. A direct line runs from Darwin to the extermination camps of Nazi Europe. I agree. Absolutely. He was an evolutionist. And you can justify this kind of thing when you believe that there is no God, and evolution and survival of the fittest is the way it goes. Fitting quote for this picture, mankind struggles upwards into which millions are trampled to death that thousands may mount on their bodies. This is Asimov's Book of Science, by the way. Arthur Keith said, we have just seen that in evolution, is cruel, brutal, ruthless, and without mercy, the law of Christ is incompatible with the law of evolution. I agree. I totally agree. Darwinism helped further brutalize mankind through providing scientific sanction for bloodthirsty and selfish desires. And we can just go on here. Unbridled self-indulgence may be regarded as rational behavior. If evolution is true, too many organisms are born, so quite simply, a lot of them are going to have to die. You see what evolution, if you don't believe in God, but you believe in evolution, you see how that can warp your brain? These two guys walked into Columbine High School, shot up the place, killed some people. Made a videotape. One of them said, look for this football player. He doesn't deserve the jaw that evolution gave him. Look for his jaw. It won't be on his body. Some Denver Rocky Mountain News says, the clothes may give a clue to the thinking of these teenage murderers. One of them had a shirt that said, natural selection. That's the driving force for evolution. Their textbook said that's evolution. How about that? Your large brain is a result of natural selection. Right after that, 5-year-old came to school with a BB gun, tried to shoot up the place. Unbelievable. What are the textbooks telling kids? You're an animal and share a common heritage with earthworms. Wow. Is it any wonder that kids are behaving the way they are? That's not the way God looks at you. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And my prayer is, and for you watching, that you'll take God up on this, that you'll accept his Son, that you can have everlasting life. Because God judged the world once, and he's going to do it again. In the next session, the last session, we're going to show you how God did judge this world in the most catastrophic, I would say, the second biggest catastrophe ever to touch planet Earth. And the evidence is all around us, so that we can be sure that he's going to do it again. And I hope you'll come and join us for that. Thank you.